2012-1544. Mr. Fall, whenever you're ready. You're right on it.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. I'm Brian Fall with Federal Defender Services of Wisconsin, and I'm here today on behalf of Linda Townsend. Gall requires sentencing courts to consider a defendant's principal sentencing argument. Here, the district court failed to acknowledge, much less consider, Townsend's principal sentencing argument regarding her relative culpability in the tax fraud scheme. Her arguments were specific to the case, supported by the record, and not so weak as to not merit discussion.
Why weren't these presented as an argument for a role adjustment, a mitigating role adjustment under the guidelines?
I'm not sure why that avenue was not advanced.
If you're asking a district judge to take, in essence, a mitigating role argument seriously, that's a way to do it.
Right, and I don't think it's not – I guess maybe the difference is that Townsend's role is not – is we have what is essentially a three-tier scheme. You had Ms. Smith on the top, who was orchestrating the whole thing. There was a middle tier, and then the bottom tier were a bunch of people who just were supplying their identifications for the filing of the tax returns that were fraudulent. The question we have is in this middle tier, it appears that the government puts Ms. Townsend solely in this middle tier, while the defense argument was that there were a bunch of other people similarly situated doing the same thing as Ms. Townsend who weren't charged, who weren't indicted, and weren't before the court. So the trial counsel wanted to bring this information to the court so they can understand that there's more people involved because by leaving Ms. Townsend solely alone in this middle tier, it overemphasizes her role in the offense. In other words, so she was not solely the one middling the returns and finding people with identification. There were others doing the same thing. And so the argument was that she wasn't solely responsible, that others were, and that the court should take that into consideration when imposing sentence. Ms. Townsend submitted this argument or proposed argument for the first time in her sentencing memo. And I think that's important because, one, it signifies the importance to Ms. Townsend, this argument that she set it forth and gave it to the court a week ahead of time to give the court, to give counsel for the government, ample time to consider and address those arguments at the sentencing hearing. And then Ms. Townsend, when counsel went on to actually address this argument at sentencing. So it was raised in her sentencing memorandum and during the sentencing hearing. The district court did not address this argument at all when imposing sentence. This argument was specific to her case, supported by the record, including all the information came from discovery tendered to the defense by the government. So this was a fact-specific argument that was not so weak as to not merit discussion, and it was supported by the record. Given these facts, the district court should have, at the very least, acknowledged, but should have considered and addressed her arguments on the record before imposing sentence. The district court did not. In failing to do so, it committed procedural error, and the case should be remanded.
Now, what the court did was, in light of those comments, and I agree, didn't specifically address this particular argument, but indicated she was not a ringleader, pointed out that she'd received no enhancement for her role, and, you know, talked about her role specifically, that she wasn't just filing the return, she was encouraging the filing return, she was recruiting people, and specifically was concerned about the fact it involved her four children.
Right. And all those factors would support the sentence. We're not arguing that the factors here were insufficient to support the sentence.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is those other people, all those other people that are similarly situated, that were not charged, could have received the very same sentence. I mean,
We don't. And the fact that we can't tell from the record whether they would have or what the considerations the judge made to determine whether or not it would have or those things, it doesn't allow this court the opportunity to review that question.
Frankly, counsel, I guess you've relied on our line of cases to talk about how the district court has to respond and explain, and then there's another line of cases that in essence say the district judge doesn't have to belabor the obvious. And in light of the district judge's comments that she did recruit others, including her own children, and she wasn't getting a role enhancement, I'm wondering what more was really needed with respect to the a mitigating role argument that was not asserted under the guidelines.
Right, and I think the difference is this isn't a guideline mitigate leader organizer versus lesser role.
Looks like it, though. So, yeah. I mean,
this is that it seems to me that the way that the government and as the scheme was characterized in the plea agreement, in the PSR and by the government, it seems to put Ms. Townsend solely alone in this middle tier. And counsel's argument was hopefully to acknowledge that, to get the court to acknowledge that there were others there, so that Ms. Townsend's role wasn't overemphasized.
Is a district court supposed to impose a lighter sentence because the U.S. attorney has not filed charges against other people?
No, whether or not the district court could, once it had heard Ms. Townsend's argument, acknowledge it, could reject it. The problem here is that the district court did not.
But by just saying that she wasn't the major player, then the other thing is she doesn't dispute that she was personally responsible for an intended loss of nearly $220,000. And the ultimate loss here was how much?
$1.5 million.
So we're not talking about a $20 million loss case. I mean, when we look at her relative, the amount that she was responsible for, and that she participated in one-third of the fraudulent returns. So she didn't make the argument. She didn't say, you know, I only did two or three or what. I mean, I understand the court didn't use those exact words. I have looked at all the people who have not been charged. I have compared her to them. And I reject the argument that counsel has made. But in characterizing her behavior, he certainly took into account her role.
I think he took her role, but I'm not sure, and I'm not clear that it took her role in comparison to the others. As you said, it's one-third of the tax returns, but it's one-seventh of the overall loss amount, which in itself suggests that there's other players involved.
Now what you would like us to do is have a rule that says that not only do district judges have to take into account the defendants who are actually charged, but they have to look at uncharged defendants and sort of speculate that what is represented by either side as to the role of these uncharged people is appropriate to consider for sentencing.
No, Your Honor, I'm not advocating that rule. What I'm advocating is this: what this court has already ruled is that when defense counsel makes an argument, supports it in the record with facts, with examples that the court can delve into, that the court should consider it and then accept it or reject it if it wants, but it must do so on the record so that the parties, the public, understand what exactly the sentence was based upon.
All right.
If I could just ask you a question. These kinds of appeals come up all the time right now,
yes.
Right? Has the district judge said too much, too little in the sentencing? And I'm wondering if maybe it wouldn't be a useful idea to say that the defense is required to identify your arguments. Here are the ones we think you have to respond to, Judge.
One, two, three, four. I think that would be a great idea, Your Honor. And, in fact, the sentencing memo here essentially does that. And so when you have a sentencing memorandum that you give to the court a week in advance of sentencing where you're outlining this issue, I think it's reasonable to assume that the district court will then address that issue. Whether it accepts it or rejects it, it will at least consider it and discuss it on the record.
And then was there any request by the defense for the court to address it since the court had not addressed it during the sentencing? To say, oh, Judge, you know, before you get there, I know you're getting ready to impose, but you haven't addressed our point about these other individuals who were involved. Was that done on the record?
No, that was not. It was, sentencing counsel did reference this relative culpability during her presentation of argument, but after that she did not further say, well, Judge, you're imposing sentence. It doesn't sound like you've talked about my argument. Could you please put that on the record? She did not do that.
All right. Why don't you save some time for rebuttal? Mr. Koenig, you're back up in the box again.
Good morning again, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Jonathan Koenig, appearing on behalf of the government. I'm intrigued by Judge Hamilton's last question because usually the government is the party that bears the risk associated with not raising its hand during a hearing and saying, Your Honor, are those findings related to supervised release? Those kinds of clarifying questions. But this Court's decision in Chapman, which is fairly recent, suggests that criminal defendants at sentencing do have a burden to bring information before the court, not indirectly, but to put it front and center if they expect to later come back and argue exactly what's being argued in this case. I would submit that this case is very far from a case like Cunningham or Miranda, where the sentencing judge has completely ignored very significant psychiatric problems, and it's much closer to the we think the judge should have belabored the obvious end of the spectrum. And I think, as your questions demonstrated, Judge Clavert did, he may not have addressed the facets of Ms. Townsend's role in the way that defense counsel would like, but he did address her role, and specifically the fact that she had recruited others, which he mentioned a couple of times on the record. This is a defendant who was responsible for a third of the entire universe, so really it's hard to see how she falls other than in some sort of managerial or supervisory capacity in this scheme. So
there was actually a factual foundation to argue, if the government had chosen to do so, an aggravating role.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And I can't address specifically why the parties bargained for no recommendation on that point. It was part of
a bargain.
Larger plea agreement that included concessions by both sides. So we would ask you to affirm the 24-month bottom of the guideline sentence for conspiracy to defraud the United States. Unless there are any questions, I'll rest in my brief.
No questions. Thank you, Mr. Koenig. How much time does Mr. Fall have? You have 1 minute, Mr. Fall.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just one small point. Ms. Townsend accepted the facts as set forth in the PSR and the plea agreement. There was no question. She did not object to the fact that she did recruit her sons, recruited others. So in that sense, she was not making a role adjustment argument, but rather just a comparative argument that she shouldn't be set forth alone as the sole proprietor of this middle role in the scheme. And it was this additional consideration that she sought to put forth before the court.
So it would have been okay if he said everybody else was like her and said, therefore, this sentence is appropriate for 24 months because she recruited a lot of people like everybody else in the game.
Exactly. That would have been fine. And then Ms. Townsend would know that her sentence had been considered. And then as we're talking about a deterrent effect, the public could see that the arguments were considered on the record.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fall. We'll take the case under advisement. Thank you.